Chapter 5. The Emergence of Life. Life was forged by the same physical and chemical processes that shaped our planet's crust and oceans. Life is different, however, because it can undergo Darwinian evolution. Natural selection has played a key role in the evolution of plants and animals. Early in our planet's history, it also directed the chemical evolution that made life possible. In general terms, we understand how biological molecules might have evolved from simpler precursors present on the early Earth. But how proteins, nucleic acids, and membranes came to interact so intricately remains a mystery. In a well-known traveler's tale, an explorer from the west treks up an eastern mountain in search of a venerated sage. Finding the wise man in his eyrie and eager to show him a thing or two, the explorer asks, "What lies beneath the mountains we see around us?" "The mountains, the valleys, and everything else on the earth rides on the back of a giant turtle," replies the wise man. "What, then, lies beneath the turtle?" continues the traveler, sensing that his host has taken the bait. "Why, another turtle," says the sage. "And beneath that, another turtle. And then, yet another turtle." And so it goes, until the wise man, exasperated at last by his thick-headed guest, cries, "Don't you see? It's turtles all the way down." Biology has a turtles all the way down problem of its own. In The Origin of Species, Darwin hypothesized that new species arise by the modification of old, that the raw material of life is life. Louis Pasteur, Darwin's great Parisian contemporary, went a step further. In his decisive refutation of spontaneous generation, the long-held view that life can arise de novo from non-living materials, Pasteur declared with Latin economy that omne vivum ex viva, life springs always from life. In science, answers provoke new questions. And so it isn't surprising that in resolving two of biology's greatest conundrums, Darwin and Pasteur laid bare its most profound mystery. Perhaps life has sprung only from life for the past 4 billion years, but sometime, somewhere, in the earliest days of our planet, our first ancestors had to arise from something else. Rational thought about the origin of life actually predates both Darwin and Pasteur. For example, in 1804, before his famous grandson was even born, Erasmus Darwin captured the essence of biological history in verse. "Organic life beneath the shoreless waves was born and nursed in ocean's pearly caves. First forms minute, unseen by spheric glass, move on the mud or pierce the watery mass. These, as successive generations bloom, new powers acquire and larger limbs assume, whence countless groups of vegetation spring, and breathing realms of fin and feet and wing." The younger Darwin knew these lines as he pondered natural selection, and he may have recalled them again in 1871 when he wrote to Benjamin Hooker about the ultimate origin of species. It is often said that all the conditions for the first production of a living organism are now present, which could ever have been present. But if, and oh, what a big if, we could conceive in some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc. present, that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes— at the present day, such matter would be instantly devoured or absorbed, which would not have been the case before living creatures were formed. In that letter, in a half dozen lines of conversational prose, Darwin outlined the central idea that has guided scientific thinking about the origin of life ever since. The energy of nature drives simple molecules to combine and recombine, building chemical complexity until a system emerges that can replicate itself. The idea is powerful and intuitively appealing. Life, seemingly so distinct from water and rock, arose from the same planetary processes that shaped Earth's physical features. The question, is how to test it. The oldest sedimentary rocks we know of already contain at least a scrappy signature of biology, so we can't recover a direct record of life's origins from geology. The alternative is to devise laboratory experiments that allow us to evaluate the plausibility of hypothesized steps along the road to life. We can't know with historical certainty whether any specific reaction played a role in the emergence of organisms, but we can seek to understand, in general terms, how chemical reactions on the early Earth could have made biology possible. Sugars were synthesized from formaldehyde precursors as early as 1861, but only with an ingenious experiment conducted by Stanley Miller in 1953 did experimental research on the origin of life take flight. Working in the University of Chicago laboratory of Nobel laureate Harold Urey, Miller asked whether lightning could have synthesized the raw materials for life as it ripped through the primordial atmosphere. Others had thought about this question. Russian chemist Alexander Uparin and British biologist J.B.S. Haldane had both written penetrating essays on the origin of life in the 1920s, but Miller did more than cogitate. He filled a glass vessel with a mixture of methane, ammonia, hydrogen gas, and water vapor, judged by Urey to approximate Earth's earliest atmosphere, and then repeatedly ran a spark through the vessel. Within a few days, the flask changed color, tinted reddish-brown by a film on its inner surface. When Miller analyzed the fluid from which this gunk had precipitated, he found a variety of organic compounds, including amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. In one remarkable experiment, Miller jump-started research on life's origins. Powered by the energy of nature, simple gas mixtures could give rise to molecules of biological relevance and complexity. Amino acids and other biologically interesting compounds occur in carbonaceous meteorites and do so in proportions strikingly similar to those generated by Miller. Thus, what happened in Miller's flask was not some esoteric reaction likely to occur only in the laboratory, but rather a chemistry found widely in our solar system and beyond. But, as ever, the answers provided by Miller's simulation prompted new questions. Will any combination of primordial reactants do, or do biologically interesting molecules form only when you get the recipe right? Miller himself answered this one. The recipe matters a lot. Miller-Urey synthesis yields diverse and abundant organic molecules only when the ratio of hydrogen to carbon atoms in the gas mixture is at least 4-1. That means that the chemistry in Miller's beaker could have been important on the early Earth only if the primordial atmosphere was strongly reducing, devoid of oxygen and rich in hydrogen, methane, and/or ammonia. As discussed in Chapter 4, most people agree that oxygen was scarce when Earth was young, but beginning with UCLA geochemist William Ruby in the 1950s, many workers have also come to believe that our planet's earliest air was only weakly reducing, a mixture dominated by CO2 and nitrogen gas rather than methane and ammonia. If the early atmosphere was indeed so weakly reducing, we need to look elsewhere for the kilns where biology's bricks were made. Where might we look? More fundamentally, what should we be looking for? Modern cells share a number of key features. Figure 5.1. All have membranes that line the cell's exterior and regulate molecular traffic into and out of the cytoplasm. Cells also synthesize proteins that catalyze chemical reactions or provide structural support. And cells maintain a chemical library of information in the form of DNA. Critically important, membranes, proteins, and DNA continually interact within the cell. An impressive arsenal of proteins enables cells to consult the DNA library, replicate it in toto, or transcribe portions of it into RNA messages that provide blueprints for the formation of more proteins. The translation of RNA messages takes place in ribosomes, chemical factories made of protein and RNA woven together. Organisms also grow and reproduce, requiring that they take up materials and energy from their surroundings. Metabolism employs still more proteins, some of them embedded in the cell's membranes. Even the simplest living organisms, then, are tremendously sophisticated molecular machines. The earliest life forms had to be much, much simpler. We need to think about a family of molecules simple enough to form by physical processes, yet sufficiently complicated to lay the evolutionary groundwork for living cells. Such molecules would have contained information and structure sufficient to replicate themselves and, eventually, to direct the synthesis of other compounds that could catalyze replication with increasing efficiency. And molecules able to initiate an evolutionary trajectory through which life could wean itself from the physical processes that gave it birth, synthesizing molecules needed for growth rather than incorporating them from the ambient environment, and tapping chemical or solar energy to fuel the workings of the cell. RNA holds a special place in this line of thinking, Figure 5.2. Long known for its functions in the translation of DNA into protein, RNA once seemed to be biology's handmaiden, a mere go-between in a molecular drama dominated by DNA and proteins. As early as 1968, however, Nobel laureate Francis Crick envisioned a much grander role for RNA in life's earliest history. Possibly, he mused, the first enzyme was an RNA molecule with replicase properties. At the time it was written, Crick's speculation probably struck many as daft. By the mid-1980s, however, it proved prophetic. Crick's prophecy was fulfilled in Thomas Setch's lab at the University of Colorado. In studies of the ciliate protozoan Tetrahymena thermophila, Setch and his students had found that RNA destined for use in ribosomes was modified between the time of its transcription and the moment it glommed onto ribosomal proteins. Somehow, molecular surgeons snipped away an unwanted segment of the RNA molecule and then neatly spliced the remaining pieces back together. What enzymes, Setch asked, catalyzed this reaction? Setch's team began by purifying the unedited RNA sequence. Then they added it to a solution of proteins extracted from the ciliate's nucleus. Not surprisingly, cutting and pasting of the RNA proceeded just as it does in the cell. The molecular catalyst was somewhere in the beaker. All good experiments, however, include controls designed to make sure that observed results aren't produced by circumstances other than those being tested. So the team prepared additional test tubes with RNA, but no proteins. And that's where the surprise came. When Setch inspected the controls, he found that the RNA editing took place even when proteins were absent. The control experiment, usually the most mundane part of laboratory research, led Setch's team to an electrifying conclusion. The RNA had excised the snippet by itself and spliced itself back together again. RNA could store information like DNA and catalyze reactions like proteins. The discovery of RNA enzymes, or ribozymes, made independently at about the same time by Yale biochemist Sidney Altman, had, dare I say it, a catalytic effect on thinking about life's origins. As philosopher of biology Iris Fry put it, this remarkable molecule emerged as both chicken and egg in the riddle of life's origins. In 1986, Walter Gilbert, a Harvard colleague, crafted a short but stimulating essay whose title, The RNA World, came to symbolize a conceptual way station in the evolution of biochemical complexity. As Gilbert saw it, RNA was the information-rich molecule that could form by self-organization and catalyze its own replication. Later, as life matured, evolution introduced a division of labor, with double helices of DNA providing a more stable library, while intricately folded proteins took over most catalytic functions. This road to biology is tremendously appealing, but it contains a number of speed bumps. First and most important is the difficulty of making RNA under plausible prebiotic conditions. RNA molecules contain a backbone of the 5-carbon sugar ribose and phosphate, PO4-3-, joined together in a chain, figure 5.2. 4 bases, chemical compounds built from rings of carbon and nitrogen, attach to the sugars, imparting molecular information. The bases can be synthesized easily enough. In 1961, Spanish biochemist Juan Oro showed that one of them, adenine, could form directly by combining 5 molecules of hydrogen cyanide, the modus operandi in many a detective story and likely present on the young Earth. Ribose, on the other hand, isn't so easy to explain. As noted earlier, sugars can be synthesized from solutions containing formaldehyde, probably also present in our planet's infancy. But ribose is only one of many products, and a minor one at that. The processes by which this sugar might have been thrust onto prebiotic center stage are not obvious. Worst of all, even if we could produce the right components, combining them to form nucleotides, the building blocks of nucleic acids, is daunting. To date, no one has figured out how to do it. There is still another difficulty. Nucleotides are chiral molecules, which is to say that they come in 2 forms that are mirror images of each other, like your hands. RNA can be built from right-handed or left-handed nucleotides, but mixed chains won't grow. How, then, could RNA, which in cells consists exclusively of right-handed nucleotides, have emerged from a 50-50 mixture of left- and right-handed building blocks? Again, no one knows. The problems are so difficult that many researchers have given up on the idea that RNA was the primordial molecule of life. They suggest instead that prebiotic evolution began with molecules without handedness that are easier to synthesize and polymerize. Non-chiral molecules that form double helices like those of nucleic acids can indeed be generated with relative ease in the laboratory. Moreover, at least one of them, called peptide nucleic acid, figure 5.3, can direct the formation of its RNA complement, supporting the hypothesis that RNA could have replaced its primordial precursors later, in the course of evolution. We have a better sense of how the RNA world might have operated once it burst onto the scene. Pioneering experiments in the laboratories of Jack Szostak and Jerry Joyce at Harvard Medical School and the Scripps Research Institute, respectively, show how natural selection could have honed the function of RNA molecules. The experiments typically begin with millions of RNA strands generated randomly in the laboratory. Those showing weak ability to catalyze a specific reaction are selected and replicated repeatedly under conditions that introduce mutations into the replicates. A second round of selection ensues, followed by more replication. Repeated replication and selection yield functionally efficient ribozymes. These experiments show that many types of RNA catalysis are possible. RNA provides just the sort of jack-of-all-trades molecule needed to get biology going. They also suggest that natural selection can generate molecular order from disorder and amplify weak biochemical function. If Szostak, Joyce, and their colleagues are on the right track, evolution is not only the hallmark of biology, but a prerequisite for life. This, in turn, highlights a cardinal feature of nucleic acid replication at the dawn of life. To quote Ronald Reagan, mistakes were made. As early RNA molecules copied themselves, errors crept in so that molecular daughters included sequence variations not found in their parents. This variation supplied the raw material for chemical evolution on the early Earth, and it has fueled biological evolution ever since that time. As in many other spheres of life, the Goldilocks rule applies. If the error rate of RNA, and later DNA, replication is too high, successful variants can't be perpetuated in succeeding generations. If, on the other hand, it is too low, evolution cannot continue. That actual error rates are just right may seem a remarkable coincidence, but it isn't. It results from natural selection at the molecular level. Limited sloppiness is an evolutionary virtue. We can thus envision a central role for RNA in nascent life. Experiments show that in the presence of mineral catalysts, nucleotides can join together to form RNA, although nucleotides themselves have not yet been built from scratch, and relatively short RNA molecules can direct their own replication. From the pool of sequence variation created by copying errors, natural selection can amplify those sequences that function best, those that replicate themselves a bit faster or with fewer errors than their molecular neighbors. It turns out that much the same can be said for proteins. As Stanley Miller demonstrated, amino acids form readily under at least some prebiotic conditions, and like nucleic acids, they can join together to form peptides, the amino acid chains that fold to form functioning proteins. Reza Gadiri and his colleagues at the Scripps Research Institute have even generated peptides that catalyze their own replication. Thus, depending on environmental conditions, nucleic acid and protein precursors could have evolved in primeval oceans. Regardless of which, if either, set of molecules came first, however, the most formidable problem in primordial evolution must be the emergence of systems in which proteins and nucleic acids interact, each ensuring the survival of the other. Freeman Dyson, a renowned physicist who has thought deeply about life's origins, posited that life actually began twice, once via the RNA route and again by way of proteins. Cells with interacting proteins and nucleic acids subsequently arose by protobiological merger. The idea isn't crazy, as will be clear by the end of this book. Innovation by alliance is a major theme in evolution. Viewed as a chicken-and-egg problem, Dyson's proposal has obvious attractions. But the issue is more complicated than that, because it must also be approached as a question of locks and keys. Molecular crosstalk between nucleic acids and proteins is mediated by the genetic code, a set of chemical correspondences that allows the molecular language of nucleotides to be translated into the amino acid chains of proteins. Was the code a frozen accident, as suggested by Francis Crick? And if so, what was the nature of the accident? Alternatively, do chemical rules underlie the molecular correspondences? And if so, what are they? The origin of the genetic code, and with it the emergence of biochemically complex life, remains biology's mystery of mysteries. One further riddle remains to be explored. Metabolism weaned life from the physical processes that gave it birth, and the metabolic pathways introduced in Chapter 2 have perpetuated biology for some 4 billion years. How does the evolution of metabolism fit into the scenario outlined in previous paragraphs? Membranes made of phospholipids, molecules with a head of phosphate and organic carbon and 2 long tails of fatty acids, serve both to separate cells from their physical surroundings and to direct the metabolic traffic of ions, molecules, and energy. Contemporary phospholipids may, like DNA, have arisen during the course of early biological evolution. However, simpler molecules able to assemble spontaneously into membranous vesicles may well have existed in the primeval ocean, spherical membranes made from lipid-like compounds in meteorites look more than a little like cells. Possibly, the linkage of metabolism and replication began with the packaging of RNA, or protein and RNA, molecules inside primitive membranes. A simple experiment conducted by University of California biochemist David Deamer illustrates how this might have occurred. Deamer took a mixture of DNA and lipid vesicles and repeatedly wet and dried it. When the mixture dried, the molecules formed a layered sandwich on the bottom of the reaction flask. During subsequent wetting, the lipids reconstituted their spherical vesicles, but now some of the DNA strands were inside the vesicles. This suggests that the structural association of lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids could have arisen spontaneously on the early Earth. Moreover, Deamer and his colleagues were able to synthesize RNA within vesicles using nucleotides imported across the bounding membrane. This provides a faint glimmer of how metabolism and replication could have become linked. And once again, the Goldilocks rule is in order. Membrane function depends strongly on the length of the fatty acid tails in constituent phospholipids. If they are too short, the membrane will be so leaky that it won't work. If they are too long, nothing can pass through the membrane, an equally fatal circumstance. Thus, the first membranes, at least the first ones that worked, must have formed spontaneously with lipid tails long enough to keep large polymers on the inside, but short enough to allow smaller molecules to pass in and out of the vesicle. The key to metabolic integration must, of course, have been the evolution of nucleic acid sequences that coded for proteins able to direct membrane synthesis. Once the membrane came under cellular control, it too became subject to natural selection, leading, again, to molecular division of labor. The phospholipid tails grew longer, prohibiting passage of all but a few molecules, such as water and simple gases. At the same time, proteins became embedded in the phospholipid matrix, providing specialized gates and channels that admitted ions, molecules, and energy in a controlled fashion. Like nucleic acids, then, membranes appear to have evolved from simple, unspecialized structures formed by chemical processes to sophisticated, specialized systems constructed by the cell. The scenario outlined in previous paragraphs begins with nucleic acids or their molecular forebears and expands to include proteins, membranes, and ultimately, metabolism. Some scientists, however, believe that things happened the other way around, that life began with metabolism and subsequently invented nucleic acids and proteins. Gunther Vectorshäuser, a Munich chemist and patent lawyer, has argued the case for life's metabolic origin with particular clarity and vigor. Conventional prebiotic syntheses, he notes, work only when environmental conditions are just right. Considering that conditions may not have been right in the primordial oceans, Vectorshäuser concludes that life must have gotten started some other way, in some other place. The place he advocates is a hydrothermal spring, like those found in the Warrawoona Seaway or along present-day mid-ocean ridges. In these settings, hydrogen sulfide emitted from vents can react with iron monosulfide to form pyrite. Great chimneys of pyrite still form at the mouths of deep-sea hydrothermal vents. The reaction yields both energy and chemical reducing power in the form of hydrogen, powering, in Vectorshäuser's scenario, the fixation of carbon dioxide, or carbon monoxide, to form organic compounds on the surfaces of growing pyrite crystals. Could life have begun as a film on fool's gold? We don't know, but recent laboratory experiments lent support to at least parts of Vectorshäuser's hypothesis. Among other things, Vectorshäuser and his colleagues have generated acetic acid by the chemical fixation of carbon monoxide on a slurry of iron and nickel sulfides. These slurries also catalyze the formation of peptide chains from activated amino acids. Many aspects of the metabolism-first hypothesis remain to be tested, and the scenario still faces the formidable problem of integrating metabolism with nucleic acids and proteins. The experiments do, however, suggest that we should approach unconventional hypotheses about prebiotic evolution with an open mind. Mao Zedong may not have meant it when he urged fellow revolutionaries to let a thousand flowers bloom, but in research on the origin of life, we need all the ideas we can muster. Once genes, proteins, and membranes were in place, life probably climbed the trunk of Darwin's great tree of life quickly, propelled by natural selection, gene duplication, and the lateral transfer of genes. Biological expansion required that genes take control over many functions, but it isn't necessary to believe that all genetic takeover occurred in one cell line. More likely, biochemical innovations arose individually in a number of distinct lineages. One line may have made vitamin B, another fatty acids, and a third proteins that catalyze replication. In the leaky world of protocells, the gene products of one cell may have been available to all, leading to complex communities linked by biosynthetic codependence. We still live in such a world. You need your morning orange juice because your cells cannot synthesize vitamin C. Leaky membranes would have permitted genes, as well as gene products, to pass from one cell to another, allowing diverse biochemical pathways to aggregate in a small number of lineages destined to spread across the world. Early metabolisms must have been simple, employing generalized enzymes that catalyzed many reactions with low efficiency. With time, however, natural selection produced enzymes that were both efficient and specific. For example, the first bacteria to use sulfate in respiration undoubtedly did so poorly, thriving largely because nobody else could do it at all. At first, sulfate would have been harnessed using enzymes that also served other functions, but as new variants better able to reduce sulfate outcompeted their compatriots, selection for efficient sulfate reduction progressed rapidly. Of course, this selection would have come at a cost, because the better that enzymes functioned in their new role, the more poorly they catalyzed other reactions. Thus, as selection honed enzymatic function, evolving cells would have needed a source of new genes. Lateral transfer helped, although gene sharing probably slowed as increasingly competent membranes evolved. A second source of continuing importance was gene duplication. Errors in replication can result in extra copies of genes, providing raw material for evolutionary innovation. Once duplicated, the two gene copies can respond to differing selection pressures, eventually giving rise to two enzymes with distinct functions. It is relatively easy to see how selection could have driven the evolution of specific enzymes, but what about complex metabolic pathways that integrate the activities of many proteins? The molecular intricacy of photosynthesis rivals the anatomical complexity of vertebrate eyes, chosen by Darwin to illustrate how organs of extreme perfection could evolve. Darwin's creationist critics believed that the complexities of the eye must reflect intelligent design, but Darwin knew better. Among living organisms, he noted, we find a spectrum of photosensitive structures that runs from simple eye spots, pigment concentrations in single cells, to eyes with muscles, lenses, and optical nerves. All meet the functional demands of their bearers. Thus, Darwin argued that natural selection can fashion complexity from simplicity as long as all intermediates are functional. The same is true of photosynthesis. At first glance, the photosynthetic apparatus may appear to be nature's most elegant molecular assembly, but closer inspection reveals it to be her most wonderfully contrived Rube Goldberg machine, its impressive complexity resolvable into a series of components, each with its own origin and evolution. To begin with, chlorophyll, the central pigment in photosynthesis, appears to have evolved from simpler but functional precursors. The earliest of these were probably present in the prebiotic environment, whereas later transitional forms still occur as chemical intermediates in chlorophyll biosynthesis. As the biosynthetic pathway of chlorophyll evolved, each new step modified the function of the previous end product. Chlorophyll, in turn, is linked with proteins in an intricate molecular assembly called a photosystem that turns sunlight into chemical energy, figure 5.4. Once again, present-day complexity appears to have evolved by gene duplication and lateral transfer. Gene duplication elaborated the families of proteins that transport electrons in photosynthesis, whereas the paired photosystems of cyanobacteria and green plants originated in separate groups of bacteria and came together by lateral transfer. All the genes required to build and operate a photosystem occur together along a strand of DNA. Thus packaged, this functional cassette of genes appears to have migrated from one photosynthetic bacterium to another, perhaps aided by viruses or by uptake from dead cells. In metabolism, then, as in proteins, membranes, and nucleic acids, we can envision simple beginnings based on naturally occurring molecules, biological emancipation as biosynthetic pathways evolved, and finally, complex biochemistry shaped by natural selection, gene duplication, and lateral transfer. The generative power of these processes is astonishing. We are not close to solving the riddle of life's origins. Origin of life research resembles a maze with many entries, and we simply haven't traveled far enough down most routes to know which ones end in blind alleys. Yet, increasingly, chemists and molecular biologists have abandoned the early view that life originated by means of improbable reactions that came to pass only because vast intervals of time were available. Most now believe that life's origin, or origins, it could have happened more than once, involved chemistry that was both probable and efficient. There is a direct route through the maze, if only we can find it. While we have no sharp constraints on the timetable of prebiotic evolution, it appears that by 3.8 billion years ago, life may already have gained a beachhead on our planet. Some commentators worry that this leaves only a few hundred million years for life to emerge, but 100 million years is a very long time. Asked to speculate on how long it took life to originate, Stanley Miller once suggested that a decade is probably too short, and so is a century, but 10 or 100,000 years seems okay, and if you can't do it in 1 million years, you probably can't do it at all. By 3.5 billion years ago, the metabolic diversification that ensured life's long-term perpetuation had almost certainly begun. Complex microbial communities cycled carbon and other elements through the biosphere. Even photosynthesis may have been present. Earth's oldest rocks, thus, lie near the juncture where the rootstock of primordial evolution meets the divergence of genes and organisms inferred from the tree of life. Once life got going, where did it lead? By what route did the nascent biology of Warrawoona evolve over 3 billion years into the animals preserved in Kutuikan limestones? For that, we must resume our historical narrative.